An open letter from the Pope today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Pope Francis addresses the Church's ongoing sex abuse scandal in a letter to Catholics worldwide. But this critic wants action.
This letter is all rhetoric we have heard before.
And later, a Yazidi girl now in Germany is confronted by the man who held her captive in Iraq.
I was so scared. I was shaking all over. He was looking at me. I didn't know what to say.
Plus, former Ambassador Bill Richardson remembers the late UN chief Kofi Annan.
If he wasn't getting his way within New York and the UN system, he had the aura and ability and strength and stature to go directly to the heads of state.
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Pope Francis issued an unprecedented letter today addressed at Catholics worldwide. It addresses the global sex abuse crisis that continues to engulf the Church and the alleged cover-up in country after country by bishops and others in the Church hierarchy. The letter appears to have been prompted by the latest revelations of abuse here in the U.S. From The World's Religion Desk, here's Matthew Bell.
The Vatican described today's statement from Pope Francis as an impassioned letter addressed to the whole people of God. Massimo Fagioli, an expert on the Catholic Church at Villanova University, says he can't think of another papal statement like it going back at least a couple of centuries.
This pope calls what happened with the clerical sexual abuse not just as sins and omissions, but crimes.
Francis even used the word atrocities to describe what Catholic clergymen have done to children. The Pope referred to a recent grand jury report from Pennsylvania about widespread sexual abuse and cover-ups, saying they were long ignored. Fagioli says this wasn't the first time that a pope has expressed remorse for these crimes, but the atmosphere, especially in the U.S. Catholic Church, is what's very different now.
There is a bipartisan anger and rage against the episcopal hierarchy. And it's a church that has never been in this kind of situation, not even in 2002 when this scandal erupted in Boston. That is really a new situation.
When he says bipartisan, Fagioli means there's agreement among liberal and conservative Catholics alike that U.S. bishops cannot be trusted to get to the bottom of this.
I don't completely share that personally, but this is something that is certainly out there among the lay people and among many in the clergy. So this is new because there is a total collapse in the credibility of the U.S. bishops in the U.S. church.
One word that was not used in the letter by Pope Francis was bishops, but Vatican spokesman Greg Burke released an audio soundbite that did.
Pope Francis's greater accountability is urgently needed, not only for those who committed these crimes, but also for those who covered them up, which in many cases means bishops.
Burke emphasized the scope of the problem. He mentioned Chile, where authorities are also conducting an investigation into Catholic clergy sexual abuse and cover-up, and Ireland, which has been coming to terms with its own version of the scandal for a decade. Pope Francis will visit Ireland this weekend. Two prominent American bishops have canceled plans to be there with him. Cardinal Sean O'Malley from Boston and Donald Wuerl from Washington, D.C. Wuerl himself is facing accusations of covering up abuse. Anne Barrett Doyle is with a group that tracks abuse cases in the Catholic Church worldwide called bishopaccountability.org. She says Pope Francis deserves credit for using the word crimes in his letter today, but she says it falls very short of what's really needed.
This letter is all rhetoric we have heard before.
Barrett Doyle says Francis has taken some positive steps. He forced two Chilean bishops, for example, to resign, but she says more is needed here in the U.S.
I think Catholics are heartsick, especially in the wake of the atrocities that were detailed in the Pennsylvania grand jury report, and we are yearning for a specific plan for ending the cover-up once and for all. And this letter did not offer one.
Barrett Doyle says accountability is coming to the Catholic Church, with various criminal investigations playing out in Chile, Australia, and France, and she's waiting for that to happen here.
I don't know how much evidence the Justice Department needs that there is ongoing cover-up in Catholic dioceses throughout this country.
If the Justice Department can investigate the use of steroids in professional baseball, she asks, why not conduct a federal investigation into the cover-up of child sexual abuse in religious institutions? For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Officially, Pope Francis will be in Ireland next weekend to attend the World Meeting of Families. Thousands of faithful are expected for Sunday Mass in Dublin's Phoenix Park. But if you were to visit the park today, you'd notice an unusual structure across the street, a giant drive-through confession box. It has a faux wood facade and curtains through which cars enter. On one side of the structure is a great big banner that says, "Repent decades of sins in seconds." It's signed Paddy Power. Paddy Power is a bookmaker or betting company with an irreverent sense of humor. Paddy Power is also the name of the company's spokesman. We reached him in Dublin. Paddy, can you explain what's going on here?
Hi, Carol. Yeah, I can, actually, because contextually, what you have to realize is that this is a huge event. And the last time a pope visited Ireland was in 1979, where I'm old enough to have been 4 years old. And I was actually there when actually a million of the population of 3.5 million actually went to the Phoenix Park to see the pope. Right.
And that was Pope John Paul, wasn't it?
That was Pope John Paul II. Yeah. And so the pope hasn't been back since. But Ireland has changed dramatically since. And back in the day, we would have all pretended to be all really good and holy and all that kind of thing when the Pope came over to make sure that we impressed him and everything. I think now people are slightly more cynical about religion and things like that. And in fact, even though as a good Catholic boy growing up, personally, and I think we did a survey about the people in Ireland, and the vast majority of us probably haven't been to confession for over 10 years. So we're probably not quite as good and as holy as we used to be back in 1979. So we just figure before he gets here, it's a good chance to cleanse ourselves and make ourselves worthy of his visit.
Will the drive-through confession booth be there during the Pope's visit?
To be honest with you, it was a car wash yesterday, and it may be a car wash tomorrow or the day after, too.
So I'm going to ask really literal questions. Wanted to, could you drive into the drive-through confession booth and actually take confession? Is there a priest there?
No, you can drive in the confession box and feel a bit better about yourself for just saying your sins out loud and driving out the other side. And you confess to God in a private space in your car. And no, we don't have a priest. We have had a few people jump out and give absolutions to people. I'm not sure how they'll stand up.
Are cars driving through?
They are, yeah. So we thought we'd just have to set it up for photographs, things like that. But actually, there's been a queue of cars outside. We caused a bit of a traffic disturbance, and the police were coming along wondering why there was such a traffic jam. But we had to explain everything to them, and I think everyone kind of took it in the manner in which it was intended.
Now, you know, you alluded to the many changes in Ireland since the last Pope visit in 1979. Describe some of those changes.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, because, I mean, the church and state were intertwined. You know what I mean? Like, contraception was illegal. Homosexuality was illegal. Like, contraception was illegal. Imagine that. But anyway, so now we've got a gay prime minister. We've legalized same-sex marriage. We've just legalized abortion. So we'd probably be considered one of the more progressive places in the world, I think, from a social perspective. And I think that's a good thing. And most of the Irish people would be very proud of that. But what people do have an issue with is that the power that the church had in the past would have left its legacy of scandals. And, you know, some awful, awful things have happened in the past in Ireland. They're just being uncovered now. So there's quite a tense relationship, I think, between state and church now, whereas before it would have been a very kind of subservient relationship.
I do have a question. You work for a betting company. And yeah. So this kind of drive-through confession booth, you know, it's kind of satire, it's humor. And how did you, as somebody involved in a betting company, think this up to start?
It's funny to say, like, what does it have to do with betting? And the answer is absolutely nothing, really. But the Paddy Power brand in particular, like, we're a betting company, obviously. But I mean, I think we kind of built our brand in Ireland through, I guess, taking the mick out of ourselves and just been happy to kind of have a bit of a laugh, point the finger at ourselves and at society, kind of observational humor and things like that.
Paddy Power is spokesman for the betting company of the same name. The company erected a giant drive-through confession box in Dublin in advance of Pope Francis' visit. Thanks for speaking with us, Paddy.
Pleasure, Carol. Cheers.
Germany has taken in more than 1.5 million asylum seekers since 2014. Many are still waiting for their applications to be processed. My BBC colleague Lise Doucette met a young woman there who's waiting while living at a displacement camp for refugees. She's a Yazidi teenager from Iraq. Her story is a disturbing one. It involves coming face to face in Germany with a man who held her captive back in Iraq. Here's Lise with the details.
When the Islamic State group swept into northern Iraq as well as Syria in 2014, they carried out some of the worst crimes the world has ever seen. And when they stormed into the heartland of the ancient Yazidi religion, thousands of Yazidis were captured, including thousands of women who were taken as sex slaves. Some managed to escape and find what they had every right to believe would be a safe haven far from Iraq, including Germany. And that includes 19-year-old Ashwaq Ali. She says, though, her worst nightmare happened on the streets of Germany.
It was 2018 and I was at school. I went to the supermarket for lunch, and when I was walking back, a car pulled up next to me. He was sitting in the front seat. I don't know who was driving. He talked to me in German. Can I ask you a question? I said, sure. And he asked, are you Ashwaq? I was so scared. I was shaking all over. He was looking at me. I didn't know what to say. So I told him, no, who are you? He told me, I know you are Ashwaq and I am Abu Humam. I told him I didn't know him. And then he started to talk to me in Arabic and told me not to lie to him. I know you, he said, and I know what you do. I know where you live in Germany and who you live with. He knew everything about my life in Germany, even what time I leave for school and which route I take.
Were you scared?
Of course I was scared, and no one would believe it who hasn't been through it. I'm telling the truth, and I'm not the only one this has happened to. I've heard lots of Yazidi girls who had survived ISIS and who are now living in Stuttgart saying the same thing happened to them.
Well, it is known that some people with links to extremist groups managed to slip into Germany along with genuine refugees. And we do know that there are investigations underway in Germany into people with those alleged links. When we contacted the German Federal Police, they said that Ashwaq had contacted them, but they weren't able to confirm with certainty the man's identity. But just as listen to what Ashwaq had to say when I asked whether the German authorities had been helpful.
I told the police everything in great detail, and they said they would talk to the officer in charge. He met me and came to the school as well. I repeated my story and even drew a picture of my captor for them. I gave them a lot of detail. I told them, if you want to arrest him, you should check if the supermarket has CCTV so they can see that he stopped me and spoke to me. The officer said okay, but we didn't go to the market to have a look.
Are you absolutely convinced it is your former captor?
I'm 100% sure it was him. If you haven't been through it, you won't know what it's like. It goes straight to your heart. When a girl is raped by ISIS, you can't imagine what it's like when you see this guy again. When he talked to me, I recognized his voice very well. Even if 1,000 years had gone by, I would have recognized his voice. I would have known his face anywhere else in the world. When he captured us, he was with us 24 hours a day, beating us and watching us. That's why I know it's him.
Yazidi teenager Ashwaq Ali speaking in Germany with the BBC's Lise Doucette. Remembering the late UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. That's up next. Here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. The job of the United Nations Secretary General embodies certain contradictions. You manage multi-billion dollar budgets, but can't always count on countries to pay their dues. You also send peacekeepers to police global hotspots, but they can only shoot in self-defense. Kofi Annan took on those problems as UN Secretary General and became an expert at mastering the world body's power politics. Annan died Saturday at the age of 80. Former U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Bill Richardson, served alongside Annan. Today, he describes him as a maverick.
I remember when I was UN ambassador, we didn't want him getting too involved on the Iraq issue. And he sure as hell plunged in and made a very strong case for a negotiation. And in the end, he was right.
He was head of UN peacekeeping operations during the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Is that something he ever spoke to you about, his regret about not, you know, issuing a more robust cooperation?
He did say this was my unfortunate situation, but he needed the big powers to help. And the United States was, I wasn't UN ambassador then, but I think we've also felt we didn't go in as strongly as we should. And other big powers didn't get involved as much as they should.
Being Secretary General, it's kind of a tough job. I mean, you're not really controlling troops. You really have to use a lot of persuasion. Can you recall sort of observing him in that role, how he negotiated, how he dealt with situations, perhaps tense situations, trying to persuade people?
Kofi was very good at dealing both with the United States and the Western powers like France and Britain, but also trying to get Russia and China not to veto interventions. And he was good negotiating with all of them. If you look at what's happened recently, Russia and China seem to be vetoing any strong intervention by the United Nations. He was very close to big power ambassadors, but he was also very close to heads of state. He kind of had the stature that if he wasn't getting his way within New York and the UN system, he had the aura and ability and strength and stature to go directly to the heads of state. You know, I remember him talking to Putin. I remember him talking to the leader of China when he wasn't getting his way with the UN bureaucracy or their ambassadors. So, you know, he was a consummate diplomat, but he also was good at playing big power politics.
How did he deal with Putin?
Well, he was somebody that had great charm. He had a terrific sense of humor, a very gentle voice. I mean, he'd never raised his voice, but he had that reasoning that he made you feel like you were guilty if you didn't follow his lead, that there was going to be a disaster. You know, sometimes he'd exaggerate a little bit. But in the end, you know, he got what he wanted, and he made the UN a force.
Did he set a tone for future secretary generals?
I think he's very hard to replace because he always took positions. And past secretary generals, although Antonio Gutierrez seems to be making a strong move to be another Kofi, but, you know, secretary generals before and after him have not had the success that Kofi did because they didn't take the strong positions that Kofi had.
This is kind of a loaded question, but were Kofi Annan head of the UN today, were he secretary general today, how do you think he might deal with the Trump presidency?
Well, he would try to persuade the Trump presidency to not cut funding by the United States, which is 25%. But he would have a strong relationship with the UN ambassador, and I think Gutierrez does too. But I think Kofi would be more public. Although Gutierrez has a very effective private style, I think the Kofi Annan I know would have been much more public.
That was former U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Bill Richardson. It may surprise you to learn that Kofi Annan was a big fan of political cartoons. Patrick Chapat knew that side of him very well. Chapat is a cartoonist in Switzerland who draws for the New York Times as well as some European newspapers. Patrick, Kofi Annan saw cartoons as hugely influential. They can make us laugh, he said, but they are no laughing matter. What did he mean?
Yes, I think he recognized the power of cartoons and the fact that indeed they make us laugh, but they make us think. So they can be dangerous to people of power and they can get cartoonists into trouble. So that's something that is not widely known of Kofi Annan. We know his many commitments to peace and for a better world. But what we don't know is that he was really committed to the defense of freedom of speech and he was a real fan of political cartoons.
You helped create a group that was in part inspired by Kofi Annan. It's called Cartooning for Peace. What is it?
So Cartooning for Peace was born from a meeting between a few cartoonists led by my friend Plantu of Le Monde and Kofi Annan precisely more than 10 years ago at the UN. They gathered to think about the role and the importance of political cartooning and the necessity to defend freedom of speech in a spirit of dialogue. So from that meeting was born a movement which counts now more than 180 cartoonists. And so you have a center in Paris and you have a foundation in Geneva. And from 2010, Kofi Annan accepted to be the honorary chairman of the Cartooning for Peace Foundation.
And Cartooning for Peace was really created in the aftermath of the Danish Muhammad cartoon scandal. What position did Kofi Annan take in that controversy?
Well, you know, he was a diplomat, so he would not take a position. He was just trying to be helpful. I think that's one thing that we see in his whole career, trying to find solutions, trying to find dialogue, and trying to be helpful. He was a prince full of humanity. He was the embodiment of grace. He was the smoothest guy on earth. But at the same time, he had this quality that you don't find in every diplomat or politician. He was real. He was authentic and genuinely kind and caring. So we were blessed to have him as honorary chairman. And it was not honorary. It was genuine. He was really committed and really interested.
What was his continued involvement in Cartooning for Peace as the years went on?
So the Geneva Foundation, since 2012, has established a prize that we award to cartoonists in the world, not only for their talent, but for their courage. One of the very important commitment of Kofi, he would hand the prize to the winner. And you can't imagine how important that can be for a cartoonist that is threatened in his country, that is under duress, under threat, or sometimes sentenced to prison, which was the case of our latest laureate. And Kofi Annan was there and he stood by the cartoonist. That was incredibly important. I can tell you something. The latest winner of the award in 2018 is Musa Akart from Turkey. And Musa Akart has been condemned. We just learned that a week before he received the prize. He was not able to come to Geneva to get his prize because he is condemned to 3 years and 9 months in jail in Turkey. And when we met Kofi Annan, we asked him, what can you do? And he said, I'm going to write personally to President Erdogan of Turkey, which is what he did. So I can't tell you that story because he's no more there. And I wouldn't have told it if he was still with us. But he was going into great length to show his support to freedom of speech.
Patrick Chaput is a political cartoonist who lives in Switzerland. He draws for the New York Times and other newspapers. He's also vice president of Cartooning for Peace, a foundation that Kofi Annan was instrumental in founding. Thanks so much, Patrick.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Hills. It was the biggest bailout of a country in history at more than $300 billion. Now Greece's bailout is officially over, but many Greeks aren't celebrating.
Another round of pension cuts is due next year, and taxes remain among the highest in Europe. For many, it's only a paper victory.
An update from Athens, coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We've been hearing for some time about the economic collapse in Venezuela. One way to measure that is by calculating how fast consumer prices are rising. And today, the International Monetary Fund made this prediction. It expects inflation in Venezuela to reach 1,000,000% sometime this year. Also today, the Venezuelan government issued new banknotes. The authorities are, in effect, hoping to counter inflation by just taking 50s off the national currency, the bolivar. My BBC colleague Leonardo Rocha says this economic meltdown has been years in the making.
It's been coming for many years. It came with the collapse of the Venezuelan economy with President Hugo Chavez and the collapse on oil prices. So you had a combination of Venezuela depending heavily on oil prices and a government, it's a socialist government, which tried to control prices, and all that created a lot of economic instability and political dissent for at least 4 years with street protests and dozens of people killed. And that also pushed the government into a different note. So President Nicolas Maduro has been facing a rising inflation, and the situation really deteriorated over the past year or so.
These new notes, I've read it's called the sovereign bolivar and that it's pegged to a cryptocurrency called the petro, which was recently created by the Maduro government, and that the value of that is based on Venezuela's oil reserves. What does it mean? What is this new currency?
It is complicated. Cryptocurrencies and virtual currencies are very complicated to explain, but in a way it works like a gold standard. He pegged the value of this currency to a certain amount of oil barrels that Venezuela has, also gold and diamond. In a way, it's to try to give any new currency in the economy some credibility. Some tokens were issued of that, and people were encouraged to buy that as investment, and that is what, you know, the value of the new currency will be pegged to. But the new sovereign bolivars, that is replacing the strangely named strong bolivars, will be new notes with 5 zeros being cut off. They were supposed to come into force in April or May, but apparently the bills are being made in England by De La Rue, and they had trouble to pay for that and rearrange, and that was delayed and delayed. At the time, they were going to knock off 3 zeros of the currency in April, and the inflation is so high that they've decided to go for 5 zeros. So whatever was 1,000 bolivars becomes 1 cent. It's really difficult to understand for people who live in a stable economy.
When will the new notes be available?
They will be available tomorrow. In theory, the new currency is valid, is on today. But on Monday, there was a bank holiday so that people would prepare. And what we saw in Caracas and other cities is some people queuing up for petrol. Prices have been going up by a lot since last week, since that was announced. And people haven't been able actually to take out the new currencies. Anything below 1,000 bolivars won't be currency anymore because that's less than 1 cent.
Can you give an example of, say, you know, what a roll of toilet paper costs now in the old bolivar and what it will cost in the new bolivar?
The old one is 2.5 million bolivars for a toilet roll. And that is more or less the same price that many agents have been using that as an index, sort of to try to understand the economy, is the price of coffee with milk. A cup of coffee is also 2.5 million. I think it becomes 2.5 bolivars from if you take out 5 zeros from that. But I might be wrong here with the mathematics. But say with 1 million bolivars, you buy very little, probably 3-4 carats today. A kilo of meat, of beef, costs 9.5 million bolivars now. Every 3 weeks, roughly, things double in value. And that is something that people can't cope with. I myself lived with hyperinflation in Brazil in the 80s. You might be buying something for 60,000 or for 80,000. You don't know what's cheap and what's expensive. But what we heard from the opposition in Venezuela for the past few weeks, they're concerned that they're just knocking off a few zeros from the currency, but the economy is still weak. Oil production is still very low. Venezuela has the biggest known reserves for oil in the world, but they can't explore all this oil. And many people are skeptical. They think nothing will change.
There's also a lot of Venezuelans leaving the country. I mean, we hear today Brazil sending troops and extra police to a border town of Pacaraima, way up in northern Brazil, where Venezuelan migrant camps are being attacked and set ablaze. Is the exodus of Venezuelans just continuing because of the deteriorating economic situation?
The poorest Venezuelans are just crossing the border with whatever they have in huge numbers. Colombia took the most Venezuelans that have strained relations between them for 2-3 years. It's a big problem. And now Ecuador and Peru, and we're talking about countries that are not rich.
That was the BBC's America's editor, Leonardo Rocha. More economic news now, this time from Europe. After 8 years of emergency loans, Greece today officially exited the international bailout program that helped the country avoid bankruptcy. Greece hasn't paid all the money back yet, but this is a major step towards financial independence after years of crippling austerity imposed by lenders. European Union officials are touting this as a new beginning for Greece. Still, many Greeks aren't in the mood to celebrate. From Athens, Venetia Rainey explains.
In central Athens, the sun-drenched streets are filled with tourists clutching at shopping bags and drinking iced coffees. It's a far cry from the turmoil that has rocked this country over the last 8 years. Things seem to be looking up here. The economy grew by 1.4% last year, and tourism is at an all-time high. And today, finally, nearly a decade of emergency financial assistance is over.
Coming in at more than $300 billion, it's been the biggest bailout of a country in history. Mario Centeno is head of Europe's finance ministers.
Greece joins Ireland, Spain, Cyprus, and my own country, Portugal, in the ranks of countries that turned around their economies and once again stand on their own feet.
But that's not the whole story. Years of crippling austerity measures have shrunk Greece's economy by a quarter, prompting hundreds of thousands of young people to emigrate and pushing nearly half the country's elderly below the poverty line. The ongoing effects of austerity can be seen everywhere, from the political graffiti on buildings to the homeless people rummaging through bins. What pains Greek people most is that this is not even the end. Another round of pension cuts is due next year, and taxes remain among the highest in Europe. For many, it's only a paper victory.
That's bull****, I'm sorry.
Theoni Vougioukli is an English teacher out shopping with a friend in the bustling Monastiraki neighbourhood. She says she's not at all convinced by the politicians' triumphant statements.
I don't think that us exiting the bailout is going to make a huge difference. And in general, I don't think that people really care about that.
What they do care about is Greece's financial future, which is still very uncertain. And these sentiments are echoed everywhere. The bailout is over, but the shackles and the asphyxiation continue, warned one major newspaper in its Sunday edition. In Athens' central market, butchers present their finest cuts of meat for customers to choose from, chopping off juicy joints and fillets right in front of you to show off. But business has been slow in recent years. Unemployment may be down again, but at nearly 20%, it's still the highest in the Eurozone.
No, the economic situation is difficult.
Spyros is 45 and has been a butcher at this market for his life. He didn't want to give his last name, but he did share what he thinks of the end of the Greek bailout. It's a total fraud, he says.
This is a big lie, because for the old people, they cut money. I don't think that something will change.
Despite the bailout being officially over, Greece still has an enormous debt to pay off. The government must somehow continue to maintain a budget surplus until 2060. It says it will do so without more austerity measures. But for Greeks like Chris Kontos, a fashion photographer and magazine editor, that's doubtful, and he believes this financial crisis will have an impact for generations.
I might be dead by then. I mean, even my kids, if I ever have any, will face the consequences of austerity that's going to go on for almost 40 more years. I don't see how anyone can be really positive about this.
Yet he does see one silver lining.
I think we can be optimistic about the fact that in the long run, maybe Greeks will start changing their approach to their lives and the politics and social responsibility, maybe.
For Kontos and many others, real salvation for Greece lies not in more outside assistance, but in Greeks themselves. It's up to them to forge a new future for their country, and at least now, they're one step closer to doing so. For the world, Venetia Rainey, Athens, Greece.
People in New York City are surrounded by art. They have access to world-famous museums and public art installations, so it takes a lot to grab their attention. But for the past year, a work of street art has captivated lots of people. Rosalyn Tordesillas sent us this story from Washington Heights in Upper Manhattan.
Biking up the Hudson River Greenway on a summer weekend, you'll pass barbecues, softball games, playgrounds. And as you near the George Washington Bridge, you'll see this.
He calls it Sisyphus Stone because folks knocked it down 15 times, and every single time he came back up and rebuilt.
That's Maxine Daniels, who owns iBike Harlem. She stopped with her tour group at a curious feature on the riverbank. Dozens of people-sized figures of stacked stones, some over 6 feet tall, spanning well over 100 yards of shoreline.
So when you come down and look through them, it kind of looks like you're looking through a sea of people.
Each figure is made of three or four large stones, a base, a middle, and a head, perfectly balanced.
I thought they were natural initially, and I was like, how would this happen? Like, does a tie bring it in, or...
They almost remind me of sort of, you know, lost souls, people who have been here but that are now lost.
You might think the stones are a piece of sponsored public art, but actually, they're the work of one man. Ulix Grika, who also goes by Ulysses. He spends hours almost every day carefully fitting stones together. He started last summer.
There was just one simple structure, and this woman stopped by, and she said, thank you for building something like this, because today is Hiroshima. That's how I remember that it was the 6th of August.
It started as a small personal project, but kept growing. He'd come day after day to build new figures and repair those that got toppled, usually by careless selfie takers. Some knocked them down on purpose, but Ulix kept building them.
I feel that, you know, I need to spend time here, and it's my garden. Coming here every day, this is where I can free my imagination, I can free my spirit, I can free my breath.
Ulix says the stones are part of his practice of Sufism, an Islamic mystical tradition. He says his figures remind him of people from different cultures meeting for the first time and freezing to study each other.
At night, I would see the stones standing up. They would be the natives approaching, seeing the ships coming and being like silent, petrified.
Ulix was born in Albania and moved to Italy as a child. He won a green card lottery and settled in New York in his mid-20s. He's been here 10 years now. He supports himself doing odd jobs. Creating these statues has become his main occupation. And the works inspired others as well. The stones appear in blogs and online photo essays. But Ulix has decided to end it, exactly 1 year after he started it. At first, he said he'd knock the stones down himself.
Probably okay. I will take it down, yes. I don't want to...
Like piece by piece, you're going to disassemble it.
Yeah. When I leave, everything has to go back the same way it was.
But as the date approached, Ulix said he'd simply walk away.
Let nature take it down itself, little by little, so piece by piece. And that's what I'm going to do.
August 6 was a Monday, with few people outdoors in the punishing heat. But there was a merciful breeze off the river as Ulix spent his final day with the stones. He built some new figures and adjusted some old ones. He took a lot of pictures on his phone. Last time I checked, the stones were still up, but who knows for how long. For the World, Rosalind Tordesillas, New York.
North Korea's economy has improved over the last 20 years, but the country is still desperate for cash thanks to its hyper-centralized economy and crushing international sanctions. One of the ways that North Korea pumps in cash is by exporting labor to countries abroad, including waitresses who also serve as entertainers. A couple of years ago, a dozen North Korean waitresses made headlines when they defected to South Korea. Now there's evidence suggesting that their manager tricked them into defecting. The World's Patrick Nguyen has been following the story.
North Korea has a chain of restaurants. They're located all around Asia. The main attraction are these female performers. They wear spangly gowns. It's kind of a lounge act. 2 years ago, 12 of these waitresses, they magically vanish and they pop back up in South Korea. The South Korean authorities say, look, we have these women and they've defected to South Korea because they saw how wonderful South Korea is. Well, now we're finding out that that was a total farce.
How has this story unraveled? I mean, what happened?
The manager of the restaurant, he helped them defect. It turns out he was a South Korean asset. He tricked the women by saying, oh, we're just going to move to a different restaurant in Malaysia. Well, when they got on the plane to go to the other restaurant, they ended up in the South Korean embassy. And the women have come forward. One of them said, when I first saw the flag of South Korea going into this embassy, she was quite worried. And the manager said, you have to go along with this. It's too late.
What have these women been doing since they were taken to South Korea? I mean, it's been almost 2 years, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. South Korea has been super evasive about this. We know they've been heavily monitored. We know that some of them want to go back to North Korea. And we know that because a UN special rapporteur to North Korea met with some of them and they said, we never intended to come here.
How do we know what actually happened? I mean, isn't there a chance that the waitresses could have been threatened by North Korea, like, you have to say you were abducted, we're going to hurt your families back here? I mean, how do we know what's real?
The idea that 12 women who've been indoctrinated from day one have also been trained to snitch on each other, and we're supposed to believe that they all in unison decided to defect and pulled it off. That already is an absurd story that demands a lot of questions.
So where are we now? Is this kind of he said, she said stage, or is something, I mean, what's going to happen to these women?
For me, it's beyond he said, she said. It's on South Korea now, because abducting people, this is the type of thing North Korea is accused of and pilloried for. And many of them may very well want to go back, and we need more independent third-party people going in to figure out what these women actually want.
How might this whole waitress dust-up affect the new thaw in North-South Korean relations?
North Korea has said, okay, stage one in the peace process is family repatriations. If you don't send back these women, we're not going to start family repatriations. Well, they've kind of gone back on that, because actually today they allowed South Korean families who were estranged come up and see their families. South Korea at some point, I think if they're making the right policy decision, will return the women. And they will say, now we've done something that you asked for, North Korea. Can we get something in return? But if they remain stubborn about it, it could continue to be a stumbling block moving forward.
You mentioned the 89 Korean families that have been reunited today for the first time in 3 years. Are there other reunification events planned that could be in jeopardy because of this waitress case?
We know that there are tens of thousands of people who want to see their family members on the other side of the border. So the fact that relatives got to see each other today, I think that's really great. And that's something we can be genuinely happy for these families. There's an opportunity here. When the abduction happened, it was a more conservative president. Now it's Moon Jae-in. He is seen as a more liberal president. He is someone whom was actually from a family that was split by the Korean War. His family originally came from North Korea. There's an opportunity for him to say, I know a thing or two about being split from your family. My family's been through that. We're going to fess up and we're going to move forward.
The World's Patrick Nguyen speaking to us from Bangkok. Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you, Carol.
And speaking of those family reunions, my BBC colleague Mary Bicker met one of the people who's been selected to take part. Here's her story from South Korea.
Where is this?
In a basement office in Seoul, Yoon Hong-gyu shows me photos of him in uniform during the Korean War.
Wow.
한 2, 3년이면은 이 통일되는 거로.
The room is adorned with medals. He fled North Korea in the middle of the night 70 years ago, fearing the spread of communism, and he made the choice to leave his family. He's one of only 88 chosen this time around to take part in the reunions. He got a call to say he'll meet his younger sister.
After hearing the news, I was so shocked that I drank and couldn't sleep at all that night.
More than 57,000 South Koreans are waiting for their moment to meet. These rare reunions only come when relations between the two countries are good. Mr. Yoon believes this is not enough.
I want to tell the world that we should allow separated families to meet whenever they want, instead of how it is now, with few people meeting rarely. I don't want a reunion like this. I want to go back where I was born, in my old home. My parents passed away, so I would want to visit their graves in the north as well. That should be how separated families are reunited. What is this?
Thousands have died on the waiting list to see their mothers, brothers, fathers, and sisters. Hwang Rae Ha fears his turn will never come. He has never been selected. His family came south during the war, but his mother returned north to prepare for peace. She didn't return. He never gave up hope, and even build a house within sight of North Korea.
Too much time has passed by, and it is over now. I don't think she is alive. 100 people per event. When can we meet our loved ones? After all of us are dead? 100 people per event is just meaningless. There are 50,000 people waiting all over the country.
This week's reunions will bring much joy, however brief. But it will also serve as a reminder for Koreans on both sides of the border that the pain of separation has not and me never leave this peninsula.
The BBC's Mary Bicker reporting there from Seoul, South Korea. And that's our show for this Monday from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.